New Hampshire holds the first election primary in the country, and we know the results after yesterday's vote. We're looking at the race to be the Democratic Party's nominee for President of the United States, the challenger to current President Donald Trump. And we're talking about what the vote tells us and what maybe we can't glean from New Hampshire. It's the morning show. I'm Keely Woltina, in for Kate Archer-Kent. What do you think? What did you watch closely as the New Hampshire primary results rolled in? How much weight do you think we should put on one state's primary and this part of the election season? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Emily Baer is an assistant professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire. Her research examines the development and evolution of American political institutions. That includes Congress and political parties and the influence of women in politics. Emily, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Did you see any surprises yesterday as we saw the results start coming in last night?
You know, I think the results on the whole were not all that surprising. Sanders has a strong base of support in New Hampshire. He won the state by a very large margin back in 2016. He's what I would call home state adjacent, right? Just right over the border. So voters here know him, and it's not surprising that he did well. I think that more than anything, my takeaway from the New Hampshire results is that there are still some pretty deep divisions within the Democratic Party, and there's not necessarily one candidate that can build a coalition across those divisions.
Yeah, because we saw Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders taking top billing here in Vermont. And then right underneath him was Pete Buttigieg, who is seen as a more moderate candidate. Let's talk about Sanders, though. You mentioned in 2016 he won New Hampshire with something like 60% of the vote. He won again yesterday, but only with 26% of the vote. Here he is talking with his supporters.
With victories behind us, popular vote in Iowa and the victory here tonight, we're going to Nevada, we're going to South Carolina, we're going to win those states as well.
You know, Emily, because you said you haven't seen a candidate that seems to unite everybody, does Sanders have enough momentum to keep winning, to gain the nomination?
Yeah. So one of the things I'll say is that New Hampshire, in contrast to Iowa, you know, there's a clear winner, right? It's very clear that Sanders did win the race, but he has two far more moderate candidates who finished right behind him in New Hampshire. And he hasn't made a significant effort to appeal to those moderate voters who are backing Buttigieg, who are backing Klobuchar. And so far, he does seem to have, you know, really secured the support of the progressive wing of the party. Warren finished kind of a disappointing fourth, although she's looking forward to Super Tuesday and the two other early states to come. But right now, I think what we're seeing more than anything is still this clear division between the progressive wing of the party and the more moderate wing.
I just wonder if you think that the way that we are generally as a population categorizing these candidates, is it fair or is it accurate? I mean, we're talking about Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and Sanders in the same progressive camp. And then we're putting Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar and Buttigieg and even former Vice President Joe Biden in this more moderate camp.
Yeah, no, I think it's fair to say that some of those differences are very much overly simplified, right? And if you look at the voting records, say, in the Senate of Klobuchar, Sanders and Warren, they don't differ all that much. Having said that, I do think there is a division here, not just in terms of policy, but also in terms of strategy, what it is the party needs to do to win in November. Should they be making an effort to try to bring in new voters, which is, I think, the claim that Senator Sanders has been making throughout this campaign, or should they be trying to win back those so-called Obama-Trump voters, which is something that I think the more so-called moderate candidates in the race have tried to do.
And right. And there's not agreement among the candidates, but there are also doesn't seem to be agreement among Democrats who do want to see President Trump defeated. They don't really have a strategy either that aligns solidly on one of those sides of what we should do.
Yeah, no, I think it's a clear voters absolutely want an electable candidate. I just don't think they know exactly who that candidate is yet. And I think, again, the results from New Hampshire and as well in Iowa reflect the kind of uneasiness or unsatisfactory results among the electorate. They're not quite sure where they should put their support. There was a record number of kind of late deciding voters in New Hampshire. It's kind of a famously late deciding state, but about 50% of voters were still kind of undecided about a week before the election. And so that means that the last couple days, including the debates on Friday night, really helped swing voters in support of Klobuchar, for example. It'll be interesting to see if she can build on that momentum going forward.
Yeah.
And we would be seeing that among some of the other candidates as well.
Certainly. It is, we're talking about the first primary of the season. Emily Baer is an assistant professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire. And we're talking about the results of last night's primary and what we should glean from that. And your calls are welcome at 800-642-1234. Do you think any of the Democratic candidates have a chance at beating President Trump in November? What do you want to hear from them? Maybe you voted for President Trump and you're looking at the Democratic field and trying to figure out either, you know, who you'd like to see so that you can keep President Trump in office, or maybe somebody who might encourage you to switch your vote. Give us a call and give us your perspective at 800-642-1234. Emily, Pete Buttigieg had this name recognition suddenly out of Iowa. We knew he was part of the contest, but really rose to the top of the headlines. He finished second yesterday, a pretty close second, and here he is last night.
We are clear-eyed about the challenge before us, and we must be equally clear about the choice at hand. My competitors and I share the same fundamental goals: bringing balance to our economy, guaranteeing health care to every American, combating a climate crisis and a rising tide of gun violence. But we do differ in what we believe it will take to make that happen.
With the results out of Iowa and then that placement in New Hampshire, does that give Buttigieg an opportunity that maybe the Democratic establishment will rally around him?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I will say Buttigieg had a very good kind of organizational base here in New Hampshire prior to the Iowa results. So that part wasn't as surprising to me. But typically what we talk about with this early stage of the presidential nominations process is something called the bandwagon effect. So if a candidate does well in those early states, or perhaps does better than expectations, which I think certainly Buttigieg has been doing, they can build on that support in later states. It tends to bring more endorsements, more fundraising, and it encourages voters in those later scheduled states to take a second look at that candidate. And of course, with the good comes the bad. So there's obviously, they tend to dive a little bit deeper into their record as well. But that certainly gives him the momentum coming out of Iowa, coming out of New Hampshire, and going forward to the later states.
Sure, because with these arguably long election cycles, you know, there's the concern that you might peak too early and then suddenly people lose interest before they have a chance to vote you in.
Yeah, although I will say, I think that's one of the things that's a little bit different about this 2020 Democratic race is, you know, typically we would see more candidates drop off at this point, given their kind of low performance in these early states. We did see Bennett and Yang drop off after last night's results. But we still have five competitive candidates going forward into Nevada and South Carolina and likely into Super Tuesday. And so this is going to be a very long election cycle.
Yeah, those five competitive candidates that made the ballot, in addition to two others who didn't make it up for the vote. And that was Andrew Yang and Michael Bennett, who dropped out as of yesterday. We're talking with Emily Baer. She stays with us. She's an assistant professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire, which is fitting because we're following last night's primary in New Hampshire and learning who could be a Democratic contender for president. We continue this conversation with your thoughts, your ideas at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you noticed, what you're hoping to hear from candidates, and maybe even whether you think there's too much speculation at this point in the race to really help us be informed about what it might look like in November. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Democratic presidential hopefuls who landed toward the top in New Hampshire primaries are celebrating. Those who trailed argue it's early, considering it's the first primary of the 2020 election. We're talking with Emily Baer, who's an assistant professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire, about these results and what they mean, what they don't mean. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Tell us, how do you think the Democratic primary is shaping up? And are candidates addressing the issues that you think are most important? 800-642-1234. The third place finisher, Amy Klobuchar, did well yesterday, had about 20% of the vote. She seems to be battling Pete Buttigieg for this more moderate wing of the Democratic Party. Here she is talking about defeating President Trump.
We know that we win by bringing people with us instead of shutting them out. Donald Trump's worst nightmare is that the people in the middle, the people who have had enough of the name calling and the mudslinging, have someone to vote for in November.
Emily, what is it about Klobuchar that seemed to resonate with New Hampshire voters?
Yeah, so I think it's a couple of things. I think she comes off as very relatable, right? She's someone who I think is very charismatic, and people in New Hampshire, kind of average everyday people, do feel like she's someone they can relate to. She is more moderate. She has a reputation for that. Certainly for working in Congress, she's known for working across the aisle with Republicans. And at least within the context of this field, I think that's very appealing to voters. Exit polls showed that a large number of those kind of undecided voters that made their decision in the last couple days threw their support behind Klobuchar. She also did very well with older voters, so voters aged 65 and older, which comprise a 25% of the electorate here. So it's I think she's someone who they see as potentially being electable, and she does seem very relatable.
And you use those words in the same sentence, but we're back to that concept of, is electability about more extreme positions, or is it about people that you feel like are closer to the center? We do see in primaries people kind of drift to the edges of the party and then still generally try to come back for the general election. Is that what you're picking up on when you're hearing these candidates talk to people in New Hampshire ahead of this vote?
Yeah, so I think you're right. So in general, the trends we see in primaries is we see kind of candidates, if it's in either the Republican or the Democratic Party, you're going to see them kind of pull to one of those two sides. And then in the general election, they have to come back towards the middle. Having said that, New Hampshire is a little bit of a weird state in that it's a little bit more of a moderate state, right? The largest number of voters are those undeclared voters, so independent voters who are not affiliated with one party or the other. So being a moderate is a little bit more of an asset here than you would see in potentially in other states.
And you mentioned that those semi-open primaries, so voters don't have to be registered with a party in order to vote in its primary in New Hampshire. 42% of voters identified as independent in those initial results. Could some of those be people who support President Donald Trump?
Who would strategically vote in the Democratic primary to try to sway the results one way or the other?
They could be, that's one aspect of it that could be strategic. There's also the idea that it's like, well, if I get to weigh in on this, then, I could vote in good faith for someone else. But that idea there isn't a requirement that keeps them out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of that plays into the fact that New Hampshire residents are very proud of the fact that they do have the first in the nation's primary. They are very spoiled by the amount of attention they get from the candidates. And I think, frankly, they do take their role in this process incredibly seriously. They make a big effort to go out to rallies, to go out to forums, to try to talk to the candidates. They spend a lot of time talking to their friends and neighbors and family members about who, which candidate is the best, which candidate kind of most represents their views, which candidate they think can win in November and could, of course, win the Democratic nomination. So they take it very seriously. And so I think that to the extent that you do see those undeclared voters participating in the Democratic primary, it's because they really do care about this process and they want to kind of have their say.
We are talking with Emily Baer. She's an assistant professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire. We're taking your calls. What did you see in the results out of the New Hampshire primary yesterday? How much weight do you think that we should put on those results? Do you think that the candidates are talking about the right points? Do those different topics resonate with you? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you there, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren used her speech after the primary yesterday, when she didn't do very well, not to talk about her left-leaning counterpart necessarily, but about the other woman who finished in the top three. That's Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. Let's listen to Warren
now. Let's just check the facts. Amy and I are the only candidates in this race who are not either billionaires or supported by super PACs. And unlike other candidates, I don't fund my campaign by spending time behind closed doors sucking up to wealthy donors.
Emily Baer, part of your expertise is the influence of women in politics. What do you hear there?
I think there is something about the Democratic field has become increasingly more diverse in a number of ways. And there is more of an expectation now that we will see women run and run competitively for the nomination. Neither Warren nor Klobuchar have made gender a significant part of their campaign. And I think part of that is quite strategic. But I think it is nice to see women candidates supporting each other to the extent that, that will help to reshape kind of what we expect to see in executive office holders.
Yeah. Why might Warren not have initially pointed out and took a bunch of time to explain the differences between Sanders and Warren? Sanders had a really great night. I mean, does Warren still have a chance with this progressive wing of the party?
I think that Warren's kind of pathway to the nomination is really built on being a bridge between the more progressive wing of the party and the more moderate wing of the party. Again, this is a difference not just in policy, but in kind of strategy. She has made, again, her voting record is, if you look at her voting record in the Senate and her issue positions, they don't differ that much from Sanders. But kind of strategically, she has made more of an effort to reach out to what we might call the establishment wing of the Democratic Party. She doesn't want to completely blow up the party, right? Which I think is one of the things that for Sanders' supporters is an asset, right? He really does want to remake what the Democratic Party stands for and kind of what government looks like. And Warren is not trying to do that. So she's more of a bridge candidate. I think that would probably be more appealing a little bit later on in the race. So maybe come Super Tuesday, that would be a more appealing route for voters. But right now, I'm not sure in this political climate how much of an appetite there is for that.
And Warren and former Vice President Joe Biden both noted that this is early in the race. Coming off of a poor showing in Iowa, Joe Biden finished fifth in yesterday's contest. Here he is.
Tonight, though, we just heard from the first two of 50 states. Two of them. Not all the nation, not half the nation, not a quarter of the nation, not 10%. Two.
Yeah, Biden said, where I come from, that's the opening bell. Emily, is there still a chance for all of these contenders in this, despite losing the first two contests? Is it really that early?
So it is early in the process, and there are very few delegates at stake in just these first two states. Having said that, it's not great that Biden finished fifth. I think he has been a little bit buttressed by the fact that he is the former vice president. So some of the fall off in support that you would typically receive if you're coming in fifth, he hasn't experienced to quite the extent that, say, if Buttigieg had come in fifth. Again, having said that, it's not great that he finished fifth and he's got a long haul ahead. I think South Carolina is probably going to be his firewall. So if he continues to kind of drop off in support, he's going to have a very long road ahead. And it seems unlikely that he would be able to recover.
Yeah. Biden actually left New Hampshire before the polls closed and went to South Carolina.
Yes.
We've got Doug from Menominee Falls on the line to talk with us. Hi, Doug. What are you seeing?
Hi. Well, I guess you asked about issues, and one of the issues I wish was being discussed would be the deficit, because as I see it, the economy right now is being funded largely by deficit spending. It's really stealing from our children. That I don't see anyone willing to discuss that as an important issue.
All right, Doug, thanks for that. And Emily, Doug brings up the deficit. What are the big issues that these primary candidates think will help them win?
You know, if you look at exit polls from both Iowa and New Hampshire, healthcare is really the kind of singular most important issue for voters. And coming out of the 2018 midterm elections, that was also similarly ranked as kind of the most important issue for voters. I think Democrats see this as a winning issue. And certainly for Sanders' supporters, it was one of the main reasons they supported his candidacy. So I would expect healthcare to be the main issue going forward.
In this race, we do still have Tom Steyer, who finished sixth last night, and Michael Bloomberg, who didn't make the ballot in New Hampshire. At this point, is having more than these top five candidates running distracting for the Democratic Party?
So I tend to be of the belief that the more candidates in the race, the better of a reflection of the diversity of viewpoints within that party. So from a small D democracy standpoint, it's good. Strategically, though, this has the potential to open up wounds within the party that are really hard to kind of sew back together after the convention and going into the general election. So certainly there is kind of a negative piece to this, that if you care about winning, it's hard to have that many candidates in the race.
Certainly. Emily, thank you for breaking it all down for us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Baer is an assistant professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire. And we've been talking about the results after last night's primary, specific to the Democratic nominees for president. Up next is news. Then Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate Jill Karofsky joins the program to discuss her campaign. Are you an undecided voter in the Supreme Court election? How much do you care about candidates' judicial philosophies or their past legal work or who's endorsed their campaigns? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or you can email your question to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show and this is the Ideas Network. The primary vote for Wisconsin State Supreme Court Justice happens next week. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We've invited all three candidates to talk with us ahead of the election. The top two vote-getters in the February 18th primary advance to the general Supreme Court election in April. Your calls are welcome as we bring on different candidates. What questions do you have for someone who hopes to be Wisconsin's next Supreme Court justice? What do you want to say about the court's recent rulings or the way that justices approach cases? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Marquette University Law Professor Ed Filone and current Supreme Court Justice Daniel Kelly are in the primary. So is today's guest, Jill Karofsky. She's a candidate for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. She's also a Dane County Circuit Court judge. Judge Karofsky, thanks for being here with us on the Ideas Network.
Absolutely. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
You're campaigning to unseat Justice Daniel Kelly after Governor Scott Walker appointed him in 2016. Why do you think it's time for voters to have a change on the state Supreme Court?
Look, I'm running for the state Supreme Court because we have got to get this court back on track. And what I am bringing is my experience, my values, my Wisconsin values, and my energy to this race. And I'm going to bring those things to the Wisconsin State Supreme Court.
And so why do you think you're a better candidate than your opponents? One's a sitting Supreme Court justice and the other is a law professor.
Look, I'm the best candidate because of the experience that I have. I am the only person in this race who is or who has ever been a trial court judge. I presided over more than 1,700 cases just last year. In my courtroom, I see how the law impacts real people. It is not just an esoteric exercise. I'm also the only person in this race who has been a prosecutor. I know how to be smart on crime. I know how to protect the rights of individuals. And I have been a victim advocate. I was Wisconsin's first Violence Against Women Resource Prosecutor. And then I was the head of Wisconsin's Office of Crime Victim Services. I help crime victims in every single county in the state of Wisconsin get the services, the support, and the help that they needed while their case was winding its way through the criminal justice system.
Turning to the campaign, your stump speech often involves describing the current state Supreme Court as corrupt from the perspective of Wisconsin voters. Is that your personal view or that the court is corrupt?
What I have been doing is traveling around the state the past several months campaigning, and people around the state have concerns about the Wisconsin Supreme Court. What they see are justices who make decisions before anyone ever walks into the Wisconsin State Supreme Court chamber. They see justices who do not follow the rule of law. They see justices who are more interested in protecting corporations than in protecting our air and our water and our planet from corporate pollution. They see justices acting like politicians, and all of that feels like corruption to people.
But there's a difference, though, between what something may feel like. I'm not undercutting the ideas of those voters who are saying that to you, but the impression may not be the same as what's actually happening. I mean, what evidence is there for you to say that the Supreme Court is corrupt right now?
If you look at Dan Kelly's decisions, every single time he has had the opportunity to rule in the favor of the right-wing special interests on a case, he has done it. He was asked in November to cite an example when he did not do that, and he couldn't do it. So every single time he has the chance to rule in favor of the right wing, he does it. And that feels like corruption to people, because people can't believe that the law could always be on their side. But Dan Kelly always finds that the law is on their side.
Justice Kelly's response, though, to that is that he's calling balls and strikes. If it seems to fall in the same direction repeatedly, that's just because that's how the court is able to interpret the Constitution, and that they're just doing their jobs. I'm wondering how you think that translates into a problem, though, or corruption, if you feel like suddenly that's partisan, when he's saying, I'm just taking it at its word.
People in the state of Wisconsin are saying, look, how can it be that the law is always on the side of these right-wing special interest groups? How could that be? Also, what they are seeing is a court who is failing to follow the process that has been followed for years and years and years in this state. Look at the lame duck case. In the lame duck case, the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, with Dan Kelly on it, didn't even allow that case to have a hearing in the trial court. The day before it was supposed to have a hearing at 4:45, the Wisconsin Supreme Court and Dan Kelly plucked it from the trial court. They didn't allow the facts to be developed. They didn't allow a public hearing. They didn't allow any of us in the state of Wisconsin to look and to see what the facts were going to be in that case. They were so eager to pluck the case and to reach a decision. That also feels like corruption to people.
We're talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court with Judge Jill Karofsky. She's campaigning for a 10-year term on the court. The top two finishers in Tuesday's primary advance to an April runoff. What questions do you have for Judge Karofsky? What do you want to know about her qualifications or her positions? You can call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go ahead and bring in Steve from Sun Prairie now. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I have a quick question. I hope the judge will be very specific. She made a very terrible allegation about the Supreme Court calling it corrupt. She mentioned Dan Kelly. Can you be specific and name which Supreme Court justices that you think are corrupt, and tell us specifically why they are corrupt, as opposed to making a platitude?
All right. Thanks, Steve. So Steve is wondering, asking to name names as opposed to saying that the process is corrupt. Are there justices you see as corrupt?
I am running against Dan Kelly. I am running against Dan Kelly because as I have traveled around the state, people have talked to me about what they are seeing on this court. And what they see is a justice in Dan Kelly who always fines for the right-wing special interest. And that feels like corruption to people. Look, the difference is that when he was asked to come up with an example of a time when he did not rule in favor of his own political or personal interests, he could not do it. Now, I sit on a court every single day, and I can give you many, many examples of times when I rule against my personal or political beliefs. I did it just last week in court. I had a case where there was a felon in possession of a firearm. He was pulled over in Madison. The defense attorney filed a motion saying the police had no reason to pull this person over, and we held a hearing. I don't want felons to be in possessions of firearms, but when we had a hearing in the case, it was very, very clear that the police officer didn't have reasonable suspicion to pull over this African-American driver. So even though I don't want felons in possession, the law demands that police officers have to have reasonable suspicion. This looked to me like it was a pretext stop, and so I dismissed that case.
And I will say that when we talked to Dan Kelly this week, he named off some cases and said that it wasn't that he was siding with specifically political interests, but that when he was interpreting the Constitution, that was the side that he came down on, which we talked about just a little bit ago. You and Professor Fallone in this race both signed the 2011 petition to recall Governor Scott Walker over Act 10. And because of his appointment, Justice Kelly had published writings about same-sex marriage and affirmative action, other policy issues. I wonder how much should voters take into account, past actions or past weight that are political in nature when they're considering candidates for Supreme Court in this nonpartisan election?
I think every voter needs to decide for him and herself what the various qualities and issues are that they're going to look at in a race like this. And what I have tried to put forward to people is the experience that I have, which I've already talked to you about, my values, my Wisconsin values. Look, I'm born and raised in this state. My mom was mayor of my small town when I was growing up. I saw her do things like bring emergency medical service into our town. She brought buses in so folks had access to public transportation. My dad was a local pediatrician. He opened up a free clinic for teenagers as soon as he retired so that they would have access. He knew some of them wouldn't have access to health care otherwise. My parents taught me the importance of public service and of serving my community. As a single mom of two teenagers, my kids and I all went to public school. I talked to my kids about the importance of workers' rights and women's rights and human rights and civil rights. And those are the values that I am bringing to this race, in addition to a depth and breadth of experience that neither of my opponents can touch.
Professor Fallone casts himself as the more independent candidate here, highlighting your support from Democrats, Justice Kelly's support from Republicans. Do you agree with his portrayal of the election in that light?
I'm sorry, what? How did you say that?
Professor Fallone casts himself as like the independent candidate when it comes to this. I mean, technically, the race is nonpartisan, but we see political support in all of these different ways in this election.
Look, I'm really proud of the endorsements that we have in this race, and we have bipartisan endorsements. I have bipartisan support from judges and from sheriffs and from DAs from all across Wisconsin.
We are talking with Judge Jill Karofsky, and we are discussing her campaign for the state Supreme Court here on the Ideas Network. And let's go ahead and welcome Tim from Eau Claire now. Hi, Tim. What's your question?
My understanding is within the past several years, the state Supreme Court ruled that crimes less than misdemeanors, so I guess ordinance violations, should be allowed to be expunged. But in ruling that, they ended up expunging the case that they were ruling on, ultimately leaving it no record of it. I'm wondering what the judge's thoughts are on expungement of ordinance violations, specifically where the cases were originally listed as misdemeanors and then pled down to ordinance violations.
All right, Tim, that's a pretty specific question. Are you familiar with that particular ruling, Judge Karofsky?
I think I know what Tim is talking about. Look, anyone who's been in the criminal justice system for 2 minutes knows that we need to reform this system. I am the only person in this race who has been on the front line of the judicial system, and I've been on the front line of the criminal justice system for many, many years. We need to do a number of things. There's a number of ways that the criminal justice system can be reformed. Now, I'm not running to be a policymaker. I'm not running for the legislature. I'm running to be a Supreme Court justice. And I do think that it is incumbent upon those of us who are on the front lines as trial court judges to inform the legislature about things that we see in our courtrooms. That's something that I have done and that I will continue to do.
And we'll talk more about how to handle Supreme Court precedent ahead with Judge Jill Karofsky. She's a candidate for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And you can weigh in, give us an email at ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. So 7 justices make up Wisconsin State Supreme Court, and our guest today wants to be one of them. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina, and Jill Karofsky is talking with us as a candidate in the Supreme Court primary. She's one of three people vying for two spots in the general Supreme Court election. And you can send your questions, your ideas, to ideas@wpr.org, and we might be able to talk about them as we wrap up this conversation. Jill Karofsky is a Dane County Circuit Court judge, and as we left the end of that conversation, our caller brought up the idea of something that has already been decided by the Supreme Court. And one of the things that concerns you is you say that the decisions have been corrupt in the state Supreme Court. So I wonder what you think the role of precedent is. I mean, these are decisions the court has made. And if you are elected, how would you consider, you know, past decisions in what you'd be looking at then?
Well, I have to consider precedent in my role as a circuit court judge right now, and I have to do it many, many times in a day. And I follow the law. I follow the rule of law in my courtroom. I also make sure that everyone in my courtroom is treated equally and fairly and respectfully. And what we have seen in the Wisconsin State Supreme Court is a failure to follow precedent. And I can give you an example. Look, and let me just say this also. When we don't follow precedent, we don't have predictability and stability in the law. No one knows what the law is, the rules by which we are all governed. In 2016, the Wisconsin State Supreme Court made a decision in a case involving the Department of Public Instruction. It had to do with administrative rules. 3 years later, when Dan Kelly was on the court in 2019, in the end of the last session, they reversed that ruling 180 degrees. The only thing that changed, the only difference in those two cases, and this difference was pointed out by Justice Anne Walsh Bradley in the dissent, the only thing that changed was the makeup of the court. If laws in Wisconsin, if case law in Wisconsin changes only because of the makeup of the Supreme Court, how do any of us know what the law is supposed to be in this state?
So you say that then precedent is important. So which precedent is it? Because now we have layers. So if you're on the court and a similar case comes up, does the 2019 precedent come into it? Or do you bypass that and point to 2016? I mean, how do you pull that into the conversation?
Well, I would follow what the law is. Now, obviously, you know, there are examples in this country and in this state where we have had a change of precedent, and that has been good. If you think about Plessy versus Ferguson and then Brown versus the Board of Education, you know, I don't think there is anyone, certainly not in this room, who would disagree that that was an important change in precedent. But that's not what we're seeing on the Supreme Court. With Dan Kelly in that 2019 decision, what we see is a court that is outcome-driven and that is not following the rule of law because they want to get to their preordained result.
And let's bring in Patty from Birchwood now, who has a question for Judge Karofsky. And actually, it sounds like we've lost Patty, but Patty was wondering about the role of original intent when it comes to the Constitution. So, you know, that begs the question, what's your judicial philosophy then?
My judicial philosophy is to look at the facts of a case, to study the law in the case, and to apply the law to the facts in an equal and a fair and an impartial way. And I do that over and over and over again in my courtroom. When I hear words like originalism, that is code for we have an end result that we want to get to, and we are going to do what we need to do to get to that end result. What we need to do is have justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court who are going to make the right decision without fear or favor, who are going to make the right decision following the rule of law and not their political or personal beliefs.
What about the idea, though, the phrase that more conservatives use is activist judges? Is the opposite of an originalist, someone looking at how things were drafted in the beginning, someone who wants to change things, who wants to make law from the bench?
Look, I think when interpreting the Constitution, we need to look at it with today in mind. It's 2020. The Constitution is a document that was ratified in the late 1700s. At that time, African Americans were viewed as 3/5 of a person. Women like you and I did not have the right to vote. No one could have imagined that we'd be walking around with these handheld computers in our hands with access to the entire universe. It is a very, very different day today. So I think when interpreting the Constitution, we must do it with today in mind.
We're talking about the Wisconsin Supreme Court with Judge Jill Karofsky. She's campaigning for a term on the court. top two finishers next week advance to the election in April. And on the campaign trail, Judge Kurofsky, you've pushed for the Supreme Court to adopt clear rules about when justices should remove themselves from cases. If elected, when would you remove yourself from cases? I mean, especially with your breadth of experience.
So I remove myself from cases right now in my own courtroom. The rule in Wisconsin is that if you have a conflict of interest or there is the appearance of impropriety, the judge should remove him or herself from the case. And I have done that a number of times because I have had personal relationships with attorneys who appear in front of me, and I thought I could be fair, but I was concerned about the appearance of impropriety, so I got off those cases. Now, look, what we need in Wisconsin is a very strong recusal rule. This having to do with money. And if someone gives more than a certain amount of money to a judicial candidate and then appears in front of that judicial candidate should have to get off of that case. In 2016, the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, with Dan Kelly on it, had the opportunity to draft a rule, to draft a recusal rule. They could have held a hearing to gather information from lawyers, from judges, from members of the electorate to figure out how to craft the best rule. And they wouldn't even hold a hearing. The Supreme Court, with Dan Kelly on it, wouldn't even hold a hearing to get the information that would have led to a clear and a strong recusal rule in this state. It's important to have that because otherwise people's confidence in our judiciary erodes. So when I'm elected to the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, I'm going to advocate for a strong and a clear recusal rule that comes out of a hearing where we have gathered information.
And even if you don't have that rule, if someone donates $20,000 to your campaign, the maximum allowed from an individual, would you recuse yourself from cases involving them in the future?
I would recuse myself if someone gives us a lot of money, if it is a very, very high amount of money, and I do not think that I can be fair because of that amount of money that has come in, yes, I will recuse myself.
What about this idea, though, that if we have this hard and fast rule at a certain dollar threshold, that there is a danger that political donors, could give money to reshape the court to their advantage, you know, just going kind of up to a certain point and then there's no official recusal. If it's set at 20,000, if they give 19, they still have influence, right?
Yes, and that is why it is up to each individual judge and justice to get off even if they have the appearance of impropriety. And each individual judge and justice needs to decide for themselves which cases they need to get off, they need to not preside over based on that.
All right. And let's work in Cole from Sun Prairie here as we're wrapping up our conversation. Cole, you have a question.
Yes, I do. And I'd like to just say thanks to the judge for making the biggest point, the biggest argument about why she's a better candidate than the difference in interpreting law based on today's time and not just being an originalist as Kelly seems to be. And that gets into my question regarding gerrymandering. With the federal, with the Supreme Court of the United States abdicating themselves of their duty, and kicking it back down to the states, what would your interpretation of a lawsuit regarding gerrymandering be? How do you feel about where the state of Wisconsin is in terms of gerrymandering and how does it?
Thanks, Cole. Yeah, and Judge Kurofsky, big question, about a minute to answer it. What's your response to Cole?
That the issue of gerrymandering is an example of why this race is so important to the state of Wisconsin, because who we have on our Supreme Court matters. These elections have consequences. The Wisconsin State Supreme Court is incredibly likely to hear a case on gerrymandering in the next year or so. And the question for Wisconsin voters is, do they want someone on the Supreme Court who has a track record for following the rule of law, which is what I have, or do they want someone like Dan Kelly, who we already know how he's going to rule on that case? Because he always rules for the right-wing special interest if you look at his track record. So what I am asking is the voters of the state of Wisconsin to vote for Jill Kurofsky, someone who follows the rule of law, who treats everyone in her courtroom with fairness, with equally, and with respect. And those are the same things that I will do on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court.
Judge Kurofsky, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Jill Karofsky is a candidate for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. She's also a Dane County Circuit Court judge. Karofsky is in the primary race against law professor Ed Falone and current Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly. We've invited all three candidates to talk with us this week ahead of next week's election. The top two vote-getters on February 18th advance to the general Supreme Court election in April. This is The Morning Show.